From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week, we look ahead to the new Obama administration and what it promises for Latino communities.
Latinos have caught the attention of this administration to sort of reassure people that immigration is still going to be an issue.
Then we check in on efforts around the country to allow all residents to get driver's licenses, no matter their immigration status.
When you are stopped by the police and you don't have a driver's license, you are under risk actually to be deported.
And Washington Heights residents talk about a new reality show set in their neighborhood.
When was Dominican mentioned? Bachata, where is it? Washington Heights is still one of the last remaining vestiges of a core community identity.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Quédense con nosotros. Stay with us. The Sundance Film Festival starts this month in Park City, Utah, and we're taking a close look at Latino representation among the films chosen to be screened this year. Joining us from the NPR studios in Culver City, California, is Sundance Film Festival senior programmer Shari Frilo and Cristina Davila. She's a blogger and a film critic who works on programming for the festival. Bienvenidas. Welcome to both of you, and Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Thank you.
All right, Shari, so the festival has been around since the 80s. How big a part have Latino filmmakers and talent been in the festival since it first began?
It's growing. It has been growing over the course of the festival. There are more films coming through our doors than we're putting on screen, and I think that's probably going to change in the next couple of years. There's an explosion of Chilean cinema right now. This is a really significant trend coming out of Chile. The archive screening that we've got this year is El Mariachi. So that kind of indicates that we're still connected to a pretty deep Latino root in our programming.
Cristina, would you say, though, that the Sundance Film Festival has really made a real impact in terms of Latino filmmaking talent? Or is that really what the future holds in terms of Sundance and Latino filmmakers?
I think it makes a pretty big impact because Sundance has built a credibility. They're tastemakers. They're able to tell the public at large, here's a film, this is a special film, and that immediately attracts an audience out there to films that are relatively unknown.
So, Shari, when you say that you think that things are going to change in the future, what do you mean?
Well, I guess there are a couple of things. I mean, I'm certainly thinking about the demographic of the United States is sort of the big thing that's in my mind in terms of a growing market and in terms of a growing pool of filmmakers. The birth rate is down in the United States, and really the only way that the United States is going to keep up with the birth rate is that immigration is going to have to change policies to avoid our country from being a country-sized nursing home. So these are the kinds of just basic things that really have nothing to do with film, but have everything to do with culture that's going to affect the kinds of films and the kinds of audiences that Sundance has to engage with.
Right, Cristina. So here's a statistic. 1 in 4 movie tickets in the United States of America is bought by a Latino. But you, in fact, in one of your blog posts about the Sundance Film Festival, you said that at first glance, Latino representation may not seem obvious in this year's picks. So what do you mean by that?
Well, I was referring to, and the reason why I chose to write the headline WTF to sort of be loud about it is because as the announcements were first rolling out, I was hearing, you know, there's no Philly Brown this year. There's no Mosquita y Mari. Those are two films that last year made a lot of waves, got a lot of attention because they were, the log line specifically would say, you know, here's a Mexican girl from the streets of East LA, same with two Chicanas coming of age. So maybe there was this expectation that there would be two fiction films once again in the festival. So I wanted to bring attention to the fact that there are two really valuable documentaries this year.
And so what are the documentaries that stand out for you?
I'm really happy we're playing Who is Diane Crystal? It's a film in the World Cinema Documentary Competition. It's made by Mark Silver and Gael Garcia Bernal, who Canana Films produced this film. It's just very innovatively structured and told, and the beginning is the discovery of a body in Arizona. It's sort of a mystery. There's no identification on this body. As that mystery, the forensic and the crime investigation follows, Gael Garcia Bernal retraces the steps of this immigrant.
So Shari, if you're looking at Latino representation in independent and in Hollywood films, what do you think is more important? Latino stories and subjects, Latino talent and filmmakers, or having Latinos behind the scenes, or all of the above?
I'd say all of the above. I mean, the cultural power of these films are the stories. And who are behind the scenes are the ones that are creating the stories, the writers, the directors. And in terms of having a thriving presence in the industry, you've got to have folks on screen. You know, it all weaves into an American tapestry that is the ever-evolving identity of Latinos in America.
True. Well, thanks for joining us on Latino USA, and thanks for all the good work on Sundance.
Thanks for having us.
Shari Freelo is the Sundance Film Festival senior programmer. Cristina Davila writes the blog ChicanaFromChicago.com. She's also a programming associate for Sundance. They joined us from the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California. For news updates throughout the week, visit us at latinousa.org or follow us on Twitter, where we are LatinoUSA, all one word. And we're back in 30 segundos, that's 30 seconds. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In a little over a week, President Barack Obama will be sworn in for his second term in office. Cuban-American poet Richard Blanco will read a poem written for the occasion, the first time a Latino poet will have that honor. But how much Latino presence and influence will there be in the new administration? To talk about that in the new cabinet and the new Congress, we have Jordan Fabian, political editor for the English language portal of Univision News. He joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Latino USA, Jordan.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Maria.
So this is the second go-around for President Barack Obama. There is a brand new Congress, though, and that includes a record number of Latino legislators. As a matter of fact, because of the increased number of women and non-whites elected to Congress, white men are no longer the majority in either chamber. So who should we be keeping an eye on in terms of the incoming congressional class who is part of this new majority?
Well, I'll pick two from either party. From the Republicans, I think it's got to be Ted Cruz. He's the first Hispanic Republican to serve in the Senate from Texas. He's, I think, the first Hispanic person ever to serve in the Senate from Texas, at least since Reconstruction. He was elected with Tea Party support. A lot of people are comparing him to Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida. And Mr. Cruz is going to be closely watched on a number of policy fronts, from the fiscal cliff debate to immigration reform, which is going to be a key issue next year in Congress.
And on the Democratic side?
The one I'll be watching is Joaquin Castro. He's the new congressman from San Antonio. He's taken the seat of Charlie Gonzalez, who was the former chairman of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, and his brother is the mayor of San Antonio, Julian Castro, who, as you may or may not remember, gave the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention. So it's quite a political family, and I know a lot of people believe that Joaquin could one day go on to bigger and better things in the House of Representatives.
Right, and so that's a fun political game to watch, the battle between Joaquin and Julian Castro, the Castros in Texas. All right, let's talk a little bit about what kind of an impact do you think that this Congress, this new Congress, will have? What is top of the line for them, and do you think it will include immigration?
I do think it will include immigration. I know there's a lot of concern right now that the fiscal cliff might take energy away from immigration, and that's because the deal that was reached at the beginning of the year created subsequent fights over issues like funding the government, the debt ceiling, and a series of spending cuts called the sequester that we're going to have to talk about again in 2 months. Now, remember that President Obama, in his first news conference after being reelected, said that he wants an immigration reform bill to start moving in January. And what we've been hearing from the White House is that that is still going to happen, but it's also possible that those fights over fiscal and budget matters could take away attention. That being said, I do think that people, the supporters of immigration reform, are going to do their best to try to see that through this year.
All right. So in the first Obama administration,
He appointed two Latinas to prominent positions. Everyone knows Justice Sonia Sotomayor at the Supreme Court, Hilda Solis as head of the Department of Labor. We don't know if there will be any Supreme Court vacancies this term, but do we know if there are any likely Latino cabinet shiftings or appointments? Will Hilda Solis stay? Will Cecilia Munoz move on or be promoted? What's the word in D.C.?
Well, let me start off with Cecilia Munoz. I think what we're talking about before immigration, she was promoted to director of the Domestic Policy Council in the White House. So I think she's going to be a key player when immigration comes up in Congress. So even if she's not appointed to a cabinet role, she's still going to be very influential in that fight. I think if we're talking about the cabinet, I think it's actually possible that it could be less diverse than Obama's first cabinet. You have Hillary Clinton, the woman, stepping down from the Department of State, John Kerry taking her place, Ken Salazar, Latino, who's in charge of the Interior Department, could step down, and we're not sure who will replace him. So I haven't seen personally any Latino candidates for cabinet on the shortlist, but you remember, Maria, these things change every day behind closed doors, so I guess we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
But that would be fascinating, in fact, if this turns out to be a less diverse set of appointments than the last 4 years. All right, let's talk a little bit about foreign policy. Any ideas as to whether or not the president will focus some very specific attention in Latin America and, for example, on Cuba?
You know, Maria, I'm a little skeptical that the attention paid to Latin America is going to increase. It's possible that attention could be paid to Venezuela should Hugo Chavez pass away in the next coming months. But I think the foreign policy issues that are going to come up are going to be the ones we typically hear about, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the nuclear threat of Iran, and of course, China and Russia. So from what we've been hearing, I think that's going to be the consistent focus for the foreign policy of this next administration.
And finally, what sense do you have that the administration is really engaged now with the Latino electorate?
Well, it's interesting. I think Latinos have caught the attention of this administration. If they haven't, immigration reform would not be on the table, but it is in a big way. Vice President Biden just spoke to the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute last week, and it's to sort of reassure people that immigration is still going to be an issue. But looking at it from a different perspective, Latinos, I think, put the immigration issue on the table. But whether that gets done is a different story. Obviously, the politics of Congress are very complex. So I guess the people out there who, you know, want to see this issue happen is to remember to stay involved beyond the election and to talk to your congressmen and senators about whatever side of the issue you're on. But just to remind people that, hey, you're still here. It's not just a once every 4 years thing.
Pick up the phone and make a call, right?
Right, exactly.
Thanks for speaking with us again, Jordan.
All right. Thanks a lot, Maria. Appreciate it.
Jordan Fabian is the political editor for the English language portal of Univision News. He spoke to us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Around the country, many states are dealing with the question of providing driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants. In Illinois, this past week, the state legislature passed a bill which supporters say will make the roads safer by helping ensure that all drivers are trained and tested. From Chicago, reporter Dan Weissman has the story.
It would take Mayra Sarabia about 45 minutes to drive from her home on Chicago's southwest side to her job in the suburbs. Instead, she spends almost 2 hours on the road, two buses, two trains, and a mile's walk. And she leaves an hour early in case she misses a train or a bus or two. She's got a car, but she says using it isn't worth the risk.
When I drive, it's always living with the fear of, you know, am I coming back? How my kids gonna do without me?
Sarabia's three children, ages 12, 14, and 17, were born in the U.S., but she's undocumented, so she doesn't have a driver's license.
When you are stopped by the police and you don't have a driver's license, you are under risk actually to be deported. That means separated from my kids.
She feels reasonably safe driving inside the city limits.
I'm not going to be stopped because my hair is dark or because I look Mexican. I will be stopped if I violate the law, which I never do.
She drives carefully, always makes sure the lights on her 1998 Volkswagen are working, and trained her children at an early age to always wear seatbelts and sit quietly. But in the area near her job, tending the locker rooms at a suburban country club, that's not necessarily enough.
That's a suburb where the police, like, oh, you know, let's see what's going on with this Mexican.
So she's worked hard on the push for a new law that will give her the right to apply for a driver's license. Illinois joins three other states, New Mexico, Washington, and Utah, that allow undocumented immigrants to drive legally. Like their equivalents in other states, the new Illinois licenses can't be used as identity documents. You can't use one to board a plane or qualify for public benefits or show you're authorized to work or vote. But if Sarabia gets pulled over while holding one, she won't be guilty of driving without a license.
Well, I look at it from a public safety standpoint.
That's Tom Cross. He's the top Republican in the Illinois House of Representatives.
We have 250 to 300,000 folks that are driving in on our roads that don't have insurance, haven't taken a driver's test.
Cross isn't the only Republican who supported the measure. Pretty much all the state's Republican leaders got behind it. And Cross's take on the new law, that it's primarily a public safety issue aimed at making sure that all drivers have been trained, tested, and insured, is in close step with the campaign that sprung to life in early November to push for the bill. The Highway Safety Coalition registered its website on November 9th, joined Facebook a couple days later, and quickly started rounding up political heavyweights to support the legislation, all under the leadership of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, or ICER for short. According to the group's CEO, Lawrence Benito, the campaign's timing, kicking off less than a week after the presidential election in which Latinos voted overwhelmingly for Barack Obama, was not coincidental. Benito says that in the days following the election, he got calls from both Cross and his Senate counterpart, Christine Redonio, asking, in so many words, what can we do for you? Having led a campaign that registered more than 25,000 new voters in 2012, he had a ready answer.
We used the issue of the driver's license campaign to motivate people to register to vote, to be informed about, you know, what their choices were, and to go out and vote on election day. It's a reason why we actually registered more people this year in 2012 than we did in 2008.
The Illinois Highway Safety Act zipped through the state Senate in early December by a margin of almost 3-1. The House passed the bill on January 8th, and Governor Pat Quinn says he looks forward to signing it. Opposition to the idea of driver's licenses for the undocumented tends to focus less on the pragmatic specifics, getting drivers tested and insured, and more on principle, opposition to any measure that makes life easier for undocumented immigrants. Kristen Williamson is press secretary for FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform. That's a national advocacy group that favors more restrictive immigration policies.
This is not a fix that will guarantee safer roads. The safest roads are those that do not have unlawfully present people driving on them. The supporters of this legislation, Republicans and Democrats, have made it clear that they're okay with allowing illegal aliens to continue to work and live in Illinois without consequences.
Nationally, on driver's licenses, the picture's mixed. Nevada, where Latinos are widely credited with pushing President Obama to victory in 2012, is expected to pass a measure similar to the one in Illinois. But Republican governors of several other states are pushing in the other direction. Last summer, President Obama instituted Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. The program allowed some undocumented youth to apply for a status that will let many of them get Social Security numbers and theoretically qualify for driver's licenses. However, the governors of Arizona, Michigan, Wisconsin, Nebraska, and Iowa have announced that their states will not issue driver's licenses to the program's beneficiaries, and advocacy groups have filed lawsuits in protest. Meanwhile, in Chicago, Mayra Sarabia looks forward to the day she can drive to work.
I know that when I came, I violated the law. I know, like, if once I do something wrong, I will be deported, but I believe I'm a good citizen. I'm involved in my community. I pay taxes. When I have a car, I pay insurance. So I think I deserve the right to drive.
For Latino USA, I'm Dan Weitzman.
And just ahead on Latino USA, representing the hood.
It took 21 minutes to hear one sentence in Spanish.
Washington Heights talks about the new MTV show, Washington Heights. That's coming up. No se vayan.
Tengo 3 días que no como, 4 que no bebo agua.
Agua.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The neighborhood of Washington Heights is home to the largest Dominican American community in the country. Now it's also the home of a new reality show produced by MTV. It's called Washington Heights. The show is centered around the lives of nine young strivers in the neighborhood. We asked a group of Washington Heights residents to watch the first episode of the show. Here's what they had to say about representation and entertainment and how the two mix.
I am Dister. I am from Washington Heights, and I do cool things.
I am Cyrus Boki, and I'm a primary care internal medicine physician.
I'm Angelina Ramirez, and I'm the executive director of the Washington Heights Business Improvement District.
My name is John Paul Infante, and I'm co-editor-in-chief of Pineapple and Milk.
My name is Cynthia Carrion, and I'm a youth and community organizer in Washington Heights.
These ain't the Hollywood Hills. This is the Heights, one of the last true neighborhoods left in Manhattan.
A lot of, you know, the scenes in between scenes and whatnot, it was Lower East Side. And then when they showed High Bridge, which is on 173rd in Amsterdam, because I live across the street, the inside that they showed was actually in the Bronx. So they can't pull that over on me. It's painful to watch because every other scene, the name Washington Heights come really big on the screen.
If you weren't born and raised in the Heights, would it have been interesting enough as a story?
If I was a bit less intelligent, yes. Like I said, there's very little substance. There's, oh, my ex-girlfriend, oh, we're gonna fight, and oh, this guy wants to be a rapper. I haven't heard that before.
You know, I got excited to see a shot of Broadway right by my house. And whether or not I connected with the characters or not, there was something very, like, visceral for me to, like, see my neighborhood.
And now you have this thing MTV's created playing Washington Heights. So it's always going to be a little shinier, a little brighter, accentuate certain parts. You're going to add a soundtrack to it. Most of it is going to be shot at nighttime. So there's that element of it where you have, there's the suspension of disbelief when we see this, that we're just going to have to go and say, yeah, it's a reality show, and just wink at the TV, you know?
When you play with culture is when it becomes insulting. You know, I don't care what you talk about, what kind of show it is, whatever reality you want to talk about, whoever is fighting, it doesn't matter to me personally. But when you start touching upon culture and how we live and how we talk, act, and the way we live our life, that's when I'm like, all right, well, you know, I'll say my piece to whoever wants to hear it.
Although I agree that it is insulting, especially when one's a purist and one knows, like, what's going on behind the scene. One knows the reality. And on some level, this is not for people who know the reality. It's an MTV reality show. And if you judge it on those merits, I thought with the fight at the end, I enjoy. Okay, that's what I was waiting for, the climax, you know?
You're not cute! You want to do?
Some aspects were very refreshing and realistic and touching. In particular, the fact that Hispanic males, in general, are demonized, and you know, seeing Jimmy with his father in prison, I thought that was very touching.
I'm still your dad, no matter what, good and bad.
It's just been hard doing the dolo.
I know it's hard to be solo, but you know what? Always remember me. I'm watching you no matter what.
As much as it could be filled with, you know, potential stereotypes and of the imprisoned male, but this is a real narrative. This is a real issue in this community. And to see it explored in a humane way is something I'm interested in, because this is only the first episode. We need to see how that continues to be explored.
And overall, the fact that there was this huge focus on skills and goals, whether it was entertainment, whether it was the spoken word, or, you know, baseball, even though that was somewhat of a stereotype in and of itself as well, you know, whether they're working hard or hustling on some level, it's a nice way of seeing the Heights.
They're doing things, and it's cool, it's great to see that. But at the same time, I disagree, because the formula is still there. The Latino male is in prison, whether he goes to visit him or not, he's still in prison. There's still the white girl. And you're going to have somebody wanting to pursue somewhere sports or entertainment. But at the same time, you hear about the struggle and this and that. I'm like, you just mentioned, like, you guys are not poor. That's the truth. That's what I see. I'm judging. My name is Dister.
They just seem like young folks from the area, and so it was just hard for me to economically place them. You know, a lot of them looked like they were still living at home with their moms. What do they do for a living, right? Because, you know, they're going to Mama Sushi, they're getting a nail lounge. what rooftop was it that, like, they were chilling on? Because, you know, like, on my rooftop, it's really hard to do that. So,
also, you know, it's a shame to see that it took 21 minutes to hear one sentence in Spanish. And we all speak Spanish for the most part.
When was Dominican mentioned? I mean, it's assumed. Bachata, where is it? Washington Heights is still one of the last remaining vestiges of a core community identity. There still is a just inherent Dominican presence. It just becomes your standard background noise.
And to not see that, like, culturally within the language that they're speaking to, you know, I think for me, seeing the grandmother, Jimmy and his grandmother, you know, she's like, you know, like, I should, you know, yo estaba jugando contigo pelota, you know, like, that to me was really touching.
Oh, gracias, amigo, qué bueno, Dios te vino a ver, qué bueno. No fui yo que te puse fuerte.
Claro, siempre.
Porque de chiquito, de los cuatro años, te llevé a batear. Ay, yo bateo también. Eso.
You know, I would like to see more of, like, the Spanglish, because I think you hear that when you walk down the street here.
Yeah, I think I'm more in line with the abuelitas, whoever sort of owns or running the household, because most of these kids are living in somebody else's house.
I'd like to see a Dominican baby shower, because our baby showers are significantly different.
I would love to see more darker skin on the show, I mean, on MTV overall.
Yeah, I'd like to see some men playing dominoes outside, and I'd like to see some cool graffiti. There's a lot of the Heights that I didn't see. Yeah, it might have been a lot of the Lower East Side, unfortunately. There's so many treasures, and I didn't see any of that here.
That's Dister, Cyrus Boquin, Angelina Ramirez, John Paul Infante, and Cynthia Carrion sharing their thoughts on MTV's new reality show, Washington Heights.
Ya se acabó lo bonito. Ya no hay pasión en nuestra habitación, solo hay frío. Ya no queda nada lindo.
And for this week, that's Latino USA. If you have any comments or suggestions, call our listener line at 646-571-1228. 646-571-1228. Just tell us how to pronounce your name and where you're calling from. Our program is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, Deborah George, Nadia Raymond, Andres Caballero, Lita Hartman, and Michael Jones. We had production help this week from Manoli Weatherall and NPR New York, and additional engineering from Michael Simon Johnson. Latino USA is produced by the Futuro Media Group in Harlem. I'm executive producer Maria Hinojosa. Join me again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Latino USA is funded in part by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring for the home handyman or building professional. More at lumberliquidators.com. This is NPR.